The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
1 in 5 Capitol insurrectionists had military ties, a reminder that white supremacy runs deep in the U.S. Armed Forces. We'll get the history and talk solutions today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 27th, 2021. I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, if you've been hearing confusing new advice about what mask to wear to protect yourself from COVID-19 and where to get them, you're not alone. We'll break it all down. Plus, President Biden wants to fix childcare in America, and I couldn't agree more. It's unequal, too expensive, and all around broken. We'll tackle the big policy questions, all that coming up on The Takeaway. Nearly 1 in 5 people who've been charged in the attack on the Capitol this month are current or former military members. That's according to an NPR analysis. 1 in 5. A staggering percentage, but one that's in line with the deep history of white supremacy and racism in the U.S. Armed Forces, which stretches to the present and has only grown in recent years. For example, in early 2020, more than a third of active duty respondents to a Military Times poll said they'd witnessed examples of white supremacy and racist ideologies in the military. That's up 22% from 2019. Now the Defense Department says it's reviewing its policies around domestic extremists. And for Lloyd J. Austin, who was confirmed last week by the Senate as the nation's first Black Pentagon chief, it's a top priority.
The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks. And this is not something that we can be passive on. This is something I think we have to be active on, and we have to lean into it and make sure that that we're doing the right things to create the right climates.
As the Biden administration hopes Austin will usher in an era of change for the U.S. military, we're going to take a look back at the history that got us to this point and what our government and military leaders really need to do to root out violent racist hate groups from our armed forces. Dr. George Reed is a retired Army colonel and the dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And Leisha Brooks is the chief of staff for the Southern Poverty Law Center. George, Leisha, thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Tanzina. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Leisha, we're going to start with you. Where does the history of white supremacy in the U.S. military start, in your view?
It's a great question. It really starts at the beginning. I mean, we have to remember that we started with the segregated armed forces, right? It wasn't until President Truman in 1948 desegregated our armed forces. So segregated army certainly is indicative of white supremacy and a white supremacist culture. I think it's important to note, too, that the armed forces desegregated prior to the Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board. So we have, the military has really a tradition that they could be proud of in terms of leading the country away from our white supremacist history.
And the organization that you are with, the Southern Poverty Law Center, Leisha, did try to get the Department of Defense to address white supremacy within its rank as far back as the 1980s. What was the response from the department back then?
Yes, the Southern Poverty Law Center, this has long been an issue for us. Back in 1986, we sent a letter to Secretary Weinberger, and he was very receptive and issued a directive that called to reject service members that actively participated in white supremacy groups or neo-Nazi groups. The issue there, though, was that he tried to frame it that white supremacist views were inconsistent with military values, which they are. However, it still allowed for active duty personnel to kind of behave in passive and active ways that connected them to white supremacy. So it was more about their active participation, not so much about kind of, you know, their leanings or their ideology. Not that we want to keep people from exercising their First Amendment rights, but the military needed to go a little bit further. But that directive was very important. Again, we contacted DOD in 1994 and in 2006. And by the time we got to 2006, the Secretary of Defense Chu was in that position at the time, and he really dismissed our report as inaccurate, misleading, alarmist, despite the fact that we had documentation of extremists actively participating across the armed forces. So, but it hasn't stopped the Southern Poverty Law Center from ringing the bell. As recent as last year, we spoke to an Armed Services Committee at the House, at Capitol Hill, about the infiltration, the continued infiltration of white supremacists in the military.
George, we're going to turn to you. You are a retired member of the armed forces, as well as someone who's investigating white supremacy within the military. What patterns have you found so far?
Well, the policy pattern is episodic. As Leisha mentioned, typically the pattern is that when there is a very large public embarrassing event and scandal, there is a flurry of activity around policy and policy change. And then in between, there is a long period of silence and relative inactivity. So much of the pressure to make change, whether it's policy change, comes from the outside, from organizations like the SPLC, the Anti-Defamation League, and others. My interest in this started in 1995 when there was a classic hate crime that took place when three white soldiers assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division murdered an African-American couple in the nearby town of Fayetteville, North Carolina. It was a tragedy. It was shocking. And as Secretary Austin mentioned in his confirmation hearings, we woke up one morning to find racists in our midst. It was that incident that was the wake-up call.
Did you yourself witness that kind of hate during your own time in the military, George?
You know, what's interesting about this is there is a phenomenon that the people that are going to see this and experience it are likely to be minority members of the armed services in the junior enlisted ranks. I was an officer, and at the time of the 1995 murders, I was a lieutenant colonel, so I was the least likely group of people to actually see and experience it. But through my activities in command of a criminal investigation command unit, we did see it because we looked for it. We investigated a murder. We didn't investigate extremism. But in the course of investigating that murder, we found 22 soldiers that were part of a racist subculture, most of them neo-Nazi in ideology, and most of them were dealt with through administrative measures by their commanders.
I want to ask both of you a similar question about where this is coming from. George, I'm curious here because we've been at war as a country for two decades in the Middle East. Many of our soldiers have done multiple tours of duty. I'm wondering if that has factored into what makes white supremacist ideology so appealing to folks. Are they coming back and feeling unmoored? Are they coming back to the country and feeling unsupported? Or are there other reasons that are leading to this uptick in white supremacist ideology?
Yes, I wouldn't necessarily draw a connection to the operational tempo that the armed forces has been in. This problem has been around for a long time. And just think about it. The Ku Klux Klan was essentially a veterans organization, a Confederate veterans organization, you know, led by Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general, who later disavowed the organization. But nonetheless, the history goes back independent of any particular deployments or soldier reactions to deployments.
Leisha, what about you? What are you seeing that it's causing this uptick in white supremacist ideology?
Well, I agree with George. I don't know that I would mark it as an uptick. It's always been present. I would say, though, that there is a transnational movement that is accelerating the white nationalist movement. So that's true. As we experience kind of globally a pushback to multiculturalism and immigration and migration, we're finding those connections globally. So some of those things may be picked up as service members are stationed in other areas of the world, but it is a phenomenon that has existed, at least in the U.S. Armed Forces, since the beginning.
So I should be clear that when I'm talking about an uptick, I'm referring back to the Military Times poll where a third of active duty respondents said they'd witnessed examples of white supremacy in the military. And that's a 22% increase from 2019. So I was just curious about why we're seeing that. Is it more awareness, to your point, Leisha?
Yeah, I do. I do think it's a greater sensitivity to what is, what are symbols of white supremacy or white nationalism. I think that as a country, we're becoming better versed in discussing these things. It's safer to discuss these things. I would also note that under the former president's administration, there was an emboldening of amongst the white nationalist movement that made it okay to be more kind of out with who you were and what you believed. So I think it's something that's happening on both sides. Folks who lean towards that ideology felt kind of a new freedom in expressing themselves, and that might be expressed through flying the Confederate flag or, you know, sharing and showing their tattoos that affiliate them with white supremacy in some kind of way. And then, as I say, a greater sensitivity on the part of people acknowledging that it exists.
George, you mentioned that the majority of the people who are going to witness or experience this are lower-ranking military members, particularly those of color. What about the role that leadership can play in either facilitating or preventing this?
Yes, the United States military is a microcosm of the larger society. So whatever ideologies exist in society, whatever belief systems are there, they are going to be represented to some degree in the force at large. What the military counts on and puts a great deal of emphasis on is command and leadership to militate against those ideologies and belief systems. The military is very good at bringing people in from every walk of life, every socioeconomic stratus, every racial and ethnic group, and bringing them together and putting them around this thing called the mission that becomes a focal point. And it's hoped that that mission focus combined with good leadership will minimize these sorts of issues. But the leadership has to recognize when there are indicators and they have to act on those indicators, and that's not always done.
George, we just talked about the history of white supremacy, but why did it take an insurrection for people to notice the fact that one in five people in that insurrection had military ties?
Yeah, that's actually the nature of this issue. It's a hard issue. It's a distressing issue. And there's not a lot of attention on it outside of these very public events that are embarrassing, that mobilize Congress to ask questions, that mobilize organizations like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League to get involved and exert pressure that those types of groups are very capable of exerting.
Leisha, you testified about white supremacy in the military in Congress last year. What were your thoughts? I mean, did you get a sense that this was an issue that lawmakers were going to take seriously? And do you expect that that is going to change?
I do. I was very encouraged by the responses of the Subcommittee on Military Personnel that we spoke with last year. They were very concerned about the research that the Southern Poverty Law Center shared with them. And I agree with George that it takes it, that there needs to be a sense of urgency, right? That is maintained at all times. And it requires a vigilance, a real commitment on the part of command leadership. But I'm glad that you mentioned the role and responsibility of Congress. And it's their role to kind of push military leadership to make it an issue that is front and center. But I would say that the subcommittee members were very concerned and seemed not to know at all kind of that this existed as a problem. I do want to mention something that we discussed during the testimony, that the part of the National Defense Authorization Act last year included A provision that asked military leadership to actively seek out and investigate white nationalist extremism. I will point out that the Senate struck that phrase, white nationalism, from the NDA. And Aaron, I think that I raise this because I think that that's part of the issue. When military leaders spoke after community folks like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ADL presented about the our position on the issue, military leadership followed and really seemed to want to reject calling out white nationalism as a particular form of domestic terrorism that they would seek to root out. I believe that what our country has gone through over the last year, especially kind of in the aftermath of the murder of Mr. Floyd, that we began to see and recognize. It's as George says, these kind of horrific events happen and it piques our attention. I was very encouraged.
I'm sorry, Alicia, I just want to get one thing in because I want to make sure that we don't lose the focus on something George said earlier, which is the fact that it's service men and women of color, and particularly those who are lower ranking, who are more likely to witness this. George, how do you recommend service members of color who are witnessing this, who are maybe perhaps being intimidated by this, respond? What should they do?
Well, one of the good things about the United States military, all branches of the service, is there are multiple avenues for soldiers to address such things. Of course, we put an inordinate amount of emphasis on the chain of command. So going to their superiors, beginning at the non-commissioned officer level is always the first step. But you have the inspector general, you have access to chaplains, you have the opportunity to write congressional inquiries and even White House inquiries. There are so many avenues that are attuned to this. Even if it's suspected extremism, their military criminal investigative office, NCIS or OSI or CID, are avenues of reporting. So there's plenty of places to address this issue. There are lots of avenues for soldiers to address.
But George, as you well know, that addressing those issues would require institutional support, a change in institutional thinking coming from the very top down so that lower ranking servicemen and women feel safe reporting these incidents. Do you see that is happening? I know we've talked about Lloyd Austin taking over the top command post here, but has the Pentagon done enough about this, and has it created an environment where soldiers, particularly those of color, will feel safe rooting out or reporting, I should say, rather, these incidents?
Well, it's always an issue, especially if you fall into the whistleblower category. The military highly values chain of command. That's why that is the crucial link in all of this. The company commander, the non-commissioned officer, because when soldiers go around that chain of command, it's not viewed necessarily favorably. And there is a stigma associated with being a whistleblower and going to these outside groups. It's perceived by some as being disloyal, and there can be ramifications. But nonetheless, it is the right thing to do. And I think it's important that those young soldiers are couched in that perspective, that if you care about the organization, you care about your fellow soldiers, you step up and you make these reports when they're appropriate.
Dr. George Reed is a retired Army colonel and the Dean of the School of Public Affairs at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. And Leisha Brooks is Chief of Staff for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Every memory you think you have of the past,
the house you grew up in, your first kiss,
it's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
By now, most Americans know that wearing a mask is still one of the best ways to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. But the guidance around what kind of mask people should wear is shifting, as new and more contagious variants of the coronavirus make their way to the United States. Public health officials are calling for people to wear masks that offer even more protection. Dr. Abrar Karan is an internal medicine physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a global health researcher at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Karan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tanzina. Happy to be on.
So I have this huge mask collection, silk, cotton, you know, synthetics. Like, what? Are cloth masks no longer sufficient?
You know, that's the question on everybody's mind now. And I think of it a little bit less than, I think of it less in terms of are they sufficient versus are they the best protection that we can get? So we've known, you know, for about since the start of the epidemic now that this virus transmits via both droplets and aerosols. And we know that the latter are smaller particles that kind of float around in the air. And they are most relevant in terms of indoor crowding, which more and more of us find ourselves in, and many frontline workers have had to be in throughout the year. And yet only in the healthcare setting are we wearing the best protection we can, which are N95 masks, which really filter out 95% of these.
Dr. Karan, we've heard a lot about the N95, but we also are hearing about something called a KN95. Which one is better? Are they the same? N95s are hard to come by sometimes.
Absolutely. KN95s refer to masks that are actually certified in China. There's also KF94s, which are from South Korea. In Europe, they use FFP2s. These are all more or less equivalent. The problem is that the supply chain can be a little bit tricky, because there are some counterfeit masks that are on the market that have come in over the year.
How do we know if something is counterfeit? Because if it's labeled with a company that we know, that's one of my big questions when I'm ordering masks now. How do we know it's legit?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's a great question. So there is a list on the CDC website where they actually have companies that have had problems with counterfeits. So there's a way for you to check the KN95 that you bought. Go to the CDC website and see if yours is on the list of ones that has had counterfeit issues. And if it is, it doesn't mean that the one you own is not real. It just means you may have to touch base with the company. Some of them have batches that they with a certification code that's specific to the company to help with this problem.
But Dr. Karan, that's a lot of work for people who are trying to get masks. Like here in New York, people are selling them on the street. Should we trust those?
No, you're right. I mean, it is. And it shouldn't be this way, right? It should not be just left to the American people to figure this out on their own. I mean, masks are one of the best interventions we have. This is an emergency. We're in the middle of a pandemic. This really should be taken up by the CDC and our public health agencies and our government to make sure that Americans don't have to go doing this legwork themselves.
Dr. Karan, where can people buy masks or where should they be buying masks to make sure they're legitimate? Is it okay to buy from places like Amazon?
Well, you know, that is a question that's a little bit tricky because even on Amazon, the quality of different masks is going to be variable. There are some people that have sort of been independently testing masks, and there is an agency, ASTM, which is going to be coming out very soon with actually a number of measurements of different masks that are on the market that they have done. And there should be more coverage around this. I just spoke with some of the members of that team yesterday. And so I'm hopeful for that, but I don't know that CDC or any of the other agencies are officially working on this themselves.
You mentioned testing masks. Is there something that people can do to test their own masks to see how protective it is?
Yeah, well, one thing that is definitely testable right off the bat is the fit of the mask. We know that fit actually is a very big component of the ultimate protection that you get. A poorly fitting mask, even if it has good filtration material, may not provide you with the same level of protection that a good fitting mask would provide you with. So a couple of things you can do is to see how much leakage you have. When you're breathing out, do you feel a lot of air coming out of the sides of your mask? So that's one thing that I regularly do. And there are some companies that are working specifically on this problem with mask braces. Fix the Mask is one of those. And I tried a sample yesterday and it significantly improved the fit of my mask.
And I'm wondering also, you know, a lot of folks have gotten masks made for them. You know, some of the first masks that I had were handmade by people I knew. Should we not assume that homemade masks are enough, or should we be double masking?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms of enough, a mask is better than no mask. That there's no debate about. You should be wearing something. Now, if you have a cloth mask, one thing that you could do is wear a surgical mask and then wear the cloth mask over that and make sure that the cloth mask has a very tight fit so that that cloth mask can help improve the fit of your surgical mask. A couple of doctors and aerosol scientists actually looked into this and found that that could actually be a stopgap solution until we get better masks out to everybody else.
President Biden has rolled out some national mask mandates. How confident are you in those? And do you think that those are going to help more Americans get on board with wearing masks?
Well, absolutely. I think it will help in the sense that when you have federal support for something like this, it starts to enter just the general American dialogue, and masks may start to be seen as a tool to protect us rather than as a political tool that divides us. So I do think that it'll help. I know the mandate is for federal grounds and also for certain travel situations, but we really need people to be masking in all high-risk situations, anywhere with indoor crowding, and even within your own home if you've had an exposure or somebody does have symptoms and you're concerned.
Dr. Karan, at the early stages of the pandemic, we were getting, we were being told that we should not purchase N95 masks. Are there enough N95 masks now for Americans to purchase who are not healthcare workers, or should we stay away from those?
Well, the supply is very fragmented around the country. So in the hospital I work in Boston, we don't seem to have any sort of supply issue there. You know, we can use an N95 per shift and we're fine. In other parts of the country, I'm seeing there's still recommendations for healthcare workers to not even be using N95 masks unless they're doing specifically an aerosol generating procedure. I use N95s with any COVID patient that I'm taking care of. And we know that over the last year, there is a lot of investigative work done to see what had gone wrong with the supply chain. And one of the issues was the Trump administration employed the Defense Production Act, but they never really did it to the extent that was needed. So there was never enough supply, and they didn't distribute it either. They just kind of left it up to states to figure out.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Karan, but hopefully people will heed the advice and mask up. Dr. Abrar Karan is an internal medicine physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a global health researcher at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Karan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Earlier this month, editors at the Washington Post magazine asked me for a big policy idea that the Biden-Harris administration should tackle. As a new mother myself, juggling childcare and working from home during the pandemic, my response was to build an affordable national childcare system that engages the business community as well as federal, state, and local governments. Since the pandemic began, hundreds of thousands of women have left the workforce, and the burden of childcare has fallen squarely on the shoulders of working women. These pressures have been exacerbated by race, social class, and even marital status. Last Tuesday, President Biden announced his plan to address the U.S. childcare crisis for both the people who need childcare as well as the people who provide it. Biden's proposal includes a $25 billion emergency stabilization fund that would help childcare centers that are hit hard by the pandemic stay afloat, as well as provide things like PPE and other resources. The plan also provides $15 billion to low-income families that need help affording childcare. For more on managing the childcare crisis we're facing is Leah Austin, director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at UC Berkeley. Leah, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So my call for a national childcare system, would you say that that's kind of what we need, or am I just off base there?
You are totally on base. That is okay. Absolutely what we need.
So, to me, the issue is one that really presents a question of inequity within the childcare system. What does our national childcare picture look like right now, Leah?
Well, you've really nailed it in talking about inequity. We don't have a comprehensive national childcare strategy right now. I mean, really, the default strategy is to leave it to most families to figure it out. And so we have a system that was really under-resourced and really quite a frail system before the pandemic. And what the pandemic has done to the childcare system is really just, you know, in many ways bring this system to its knees. It's a system that was not working well for most parents and children. Access was limited. Many people still didn't have access to childcare. From a parent's perspective, it's costly and expensive. And on the other side, when we look at the people who are providing the services, most of whom are women, almost half of whom are women of color. And in states like my home state of California or in New York, most of the women providing services are women of color. You know, this is a workforce that is consistently among the lowest paid occupation in every state in this country. So it's really been a broken system, and the pandemic has just put more and more pressure on the system without the resources that are necessary.
Let's talk a little bit about what the pre-pandemic patchwork looked like. I was not in the childcare world before the pandemic started. I've now become a parent, and so I'm much more aware of the limitations. But what are we talking about when it comes to childcare? We're talking in-person, in-home, au pairs, daycare. What was the patchwork like prior? And about how much were Americans spending on childcare?
Well, the patchwork was really all of those things. And what a time for you to be entering parenthood and trying to manage all of this, right?
Tell me about it.
So, you know, parents are trying to put together childcare in whatever ways they can. In our work at the center I work with, we tend to focus on the formal childcare system, but even that is complicated and is delivered in many different ways. So you do have people who will, of course, are accessing individual providers, but many are utilizing center-based childcare. Many are utilizing home-based or family childcare. These are people, again, mostly women who are operating businesses out of their home. You know, group childcare, and you know, parents are footing most of the bill for childcare in this country. About 60% of childcare is paid for by parents to the tune of, you know, $40+ billion a year, with the federal government and state and local government paying a little bit through some public pre-K programs. Head Start might be the one people most hear about, Head Start programs, and some childcare subsidies. But that really touches a small segment of the population of children and families who need it. And those programs, with few exceptions, are not funded at a level that really brings the level of quality of care and services that children need and that support providers and the workforce. There's just not enough resources to make sure that the women doing this work are paid living wages. You know, there's really high levels of economic insecurity, and we see a lot of variation, you know, with in a workforce that's struggling as a whole, that there are real racial disparities in terms of who's working where and earning, you know, being paid which wages, with Black women in particular being paid the lowest wages among the educators doing this work.
And Leah, the pandemic shut down a lot of our childcare options.
It has. The pandemic has really, again, just kind of brought this system to its knees. And many programs have shut down because they simply could not afford to operate. I mean, one thing that's been interesting is we're talking across the country about reopening and, you know, schools developing reopening plans and what is this going to look like. The childcare system, for the most part, has actually remained open. There are very few places in the country that closed childcare when schools and everything else was closing. And that actually just put more pressure on childcare as schools were closed and parents were really desperate for options. So, you know, this is a system, and again, you know, women who have been operating since day one of the pandemic. But what's happened is, number one, there weren't enough resources before the pandemic, and it's just become harder as, you know, many parents weren't showing up for with their children for childcare. So that's a loss of revenue into programs. It's become more expensive to deliver childcare because you have to be operating with smaller groups. You have higher costs for cleaning and PPE and all of these things that make it much more expensive to operate.
Leah, let's talk about what this pandemic has meant for people who need childcare. We know record number of women have been pushed out of the workforce, and some of that is because they don't have the childcare that they need.
That's right. And just to return to one point that's connected to that before the break, you know, we have lost over 150,000 childcare jobs since the start of the pandemic. And so what that has translated to is, you know, losing as many as, you know, 4.5 million childcare spaces that could potentially be a permanent loss of spaces and options for children and their families. And there was not enough childcare pre-pandemic. So this is certainly exacerbating a very difficult situation. And you're right that this is impacting parents, particularly women. Again, we've known for, you know, decades that a lack of childcare, either because it's just not even available to you or because it's too costly, has impacted mothers more than it has fathers. Again, you know, estimates pre-pandemic tell us that parents, mostly moms, were, you know, losing wages between $30 and $35 billion a year because they couldn't participate in work due to a lack of childcare. And that has, again, just really crushed working moms during this pandemic. And, you know, we've long had this situation that is really coming into focus now, where our childcare system, or lack of comprehensive system in this country, has really pitted the needs of one group of women against another group of women. You have working, you know, mothers who really need childcare, and they need childcare to be available, and they need it to be affordable. And the women providing the work, because they're relying on parents to pay most of childcare, you know, the resources available to them, the money available for their wages and pay, are always directly tied to the ability of parents and, again, of working mothers to pay.
And this, so this feels, Leah, a lot of this, and I think your point is exactly, as I'm listening to you, this tension between these two groups that exists really feels like a failure on, not on the part of the child giver, the child care providers or the people who need child care, but more on our business and federal and state and local governments to not understand that if you have parents that are working, they need to put their children somewhere, especially when there are no school options available. So what do you think, Leah, are, I guess, the failure of U.S. child care policy here, but also this new proposal from the Biden administration? Do you think that will help mitigate some of the tension you're talking about here?
Well, it is absolutely a failure of policy and in terms of how policy is shaped and resourced. And so the Biden, there's two things. You know, President Biden has introduced a relief bill, which would provide some immediate resources and stabilization funds that are desperately needed for childcare programs, both so that parents can, again, access with a childcare subsidy, access childcare, and that there are resources going into programs to pay their bills and to pay their staff. So that is an immediate need. It would absolutely help to provide some much needed intervention and relief. And at the same time, we also have to be thinking long term. And President Biden, as a candidate, introduced a plan for early care and education that really centers on the workforce, recognizing that early educators, the women providing services, are the key. And ensuring that families have access. What I think we want to make sure we get right with any long-term plan is having a program that is effective and equitable for children, for their families, and for the workforce, and making sure we're looking at a system from each of those perspectives, and that, you know, that parents can work, that they have access to childcare that is open and universal, and that the women who are doing this work are paid a living wage and that they're able to take care of and feed their own families.
Leah, I want to ask you where you think the business community needs to fit in here, because a lot of people are doing this work, are working for companies, not necessarily just for themselves. And so shouldn't it be at some point incumbent upon the business community to understand that childcare is a necessity for their employees, not a luxury?
Absolutely. I think that the business community can play a really key role in helping to push for a publicly funded childcare system. I think that the business community in the pandemic has really recognized just how important childcare is, as you know, families have had to make choices about, again, leaving jobs, reducing hours, moving things around on a daily basis in some cases to try and get to work. So I think there is a real recognition that wasn't there before the pandemic. And if there's any silver lining we can find as it relates to childcare, perhaps that's it. But I do think that the responsibility of businesses is to push for that publicly funded system. I think if we lean on businesses to, pay for it just for their employees, then we're just bringing more inequity into an already, an inequitable system, with some businesses that are bigger and have more revenue and resources doing one thing for their employees and other businesses not able to do that. So I think there are ways we can look at our tax system and, raising revenue for that publicly funded system.
And Leah, finally, in my piece in the Washington Post magazine, I called for a national childcare system. Do you see that even being possible? Maybe not under this administration, but sometime in the future?
I do see it as being possible. And I think that the Biden-Harris administration can lead the charge on that. I think they have a real commitment to an early care and education system. The devil's in the details, but I think that there's a recognition of how important this is. Other countries have done it. There is absolutely, I think, the will to do so. And we can have a system that, again, is working for children, for their families, and for the women who do this every day.
Leah Austin is the director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at UC Berkeley. Leah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Christy in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I think that moms are an underrepresented, part of society that are taking an extra hit because a lot of us have had to quit work, or we're trying to work and homeschool our kids, feed our kids, everything having to do with our kids. And for example, my child has been diagnosed with dyslexia. He's 9 in third grade. So now I'm having to be a special education teacher on top of everything else. Just the amount of work, it's invisible work that mothers do.
Another Wednesday in the books, folks, and we're midway through the week. Thanks as always for tuning in. And of course, you can continue to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. We also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and send them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.